Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 39 for March 2nd, 2010. I'm Dominic Rabier, and with me today are
Ben Snetkoff
and David O'Brien.
Welcome to March. We've got three great stories for you today. The Lens v. Universal case, also known as the Dancing Baby to Music of Prince case, FCC guidelines on employer liability for employee blog posts, and Facebook's patent on news feeds. Let's dive right into our first story. This is the Lens v. Universal Music Corp case. This is originally started from a DMCA takedown of a YouTube video of a baby dancing to Prince's song Let's Go Crazy. Universal filed a DMCA complaint with YouTube and said, "They're using our music without our permission. This is a violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Please take it down." YouTube did so. The person who put the video up said, "No, you shouldn't do that. This is a fair use," and sued. Esteemed panel, do you want to go into the history of this case a bit?
Well, under Section 512 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, if once a person issues a takedown notice to a online service or a website online like YouTube, the person who is being accused of uploading infringing material then has the opportunity to send what's known as a counter notice, and that counter, under the counter notice, they can say that they believe in their view that the video that they've uploaded was not infringing, and that's what happened in this case. So we have a counter notice that was sent, and after the counter notice was sent, the video was put back up onto YouTube, and Universal, who was the production group who owns the rights to Prince's song, then didn't do anything else. And apparently, and it's not really clear what happened after that, but somehow the person who was accused of originally infringing by putting up this 29-second clip of her toddler dancing to the song then got in touch with the EFF somehow, and the EFF filed this lawsuit, and it's all under the guise of this other section in the Digital Millennium Copyright, Section 512F, which allows for a person who has been targeted, I guess you could say, by one of these takedown notices, to then file a lawsuit and claim damages against the person who originally sent the takedown notice, provided that it was knowing material misrepresentation that the activity was either infringing or that it was in some other way a violation of the copyright law.
One thing for the listeners who don't know, if there are any listeners who don't know this, the EFF is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they do a lot of great work representing people and companies who are on the, I'd say, wrong side of who are wronged by people trying to exploit intellectual property, or they often represent people who are subject to unreasonable searches of electronics by the government.
All right, so Lens won the first case, correct?
I believe this is still the first litigation. I believe the video's back up, so she's gotten the one in so much as the video's back up online, but that's just standard DMCA counter notice procedure. Right now, we're trying to figure out where this case is. What happened is she filed the lawsuit, and then Universal, the company who owns the copyrights here, has filed some motions to dismiss, essentially saying, you know, first of all, she didn't state a claim on which relief could be granted, and secondly, the case should be dismissed for all of these reasons. And the reasons they gave were things along the lines of unclean hands, and that she behaved inappropriately during the litigation, and basically variations on the fact that she acted in bad faith in filing this lawsuit.
Right, and she survived that motion to dismiss. That was the initial victory that I meant to refer to. She didn't win the first case, but that she got to past the motion to dismiss and actually got her case heard.
Right, yeah, that's where we are right now. She's gotten past this first hurdle, and now we're moving on to the next stage. Wherever that's going to take us, we don't know.
So what's happened now is that the judge has defined standards for computing damages.
Right. I think that's the big story here is that the judge had to Universal. One of the defenses that they were alleging was that there weren't actually any damages in this suit. That it was just kind of a token lawsuit. And in deciding this motion to dismiss, the judge had to determine what constituted damages under the statute.
So essentially, what Universal was claiming was that there weren't any actual damages that were imputed on Lenz, who is the plaintiff in this suit. She's the person that was originally accused of uploading infringing material. And it's a bit of a nuanced argument that's based on various readings of the statute. And if you go through Section 512 of the actual language in the code itself, it's a little bit vague as to what damages might be available to a person should they bring such a lawsuit. And the key word that was used in the statute itself was, I believe, any damages. And it was a little bit unclear, at least at the time, I don't think it had been settled in litigation up until this point, what that meant in the context of this particular statute. So the court looked at the various arguments that both of the parties set forth in their motions, and essentially they said that you can get certain damages, it could be any damages basically that might occur after you issue one of these takedown notices, but they limited it in terms of attorney's fees because under this Section 512F, it also lists that you might be able to recover costs and attorney's fees. And the court said, though, that because the EFF didn't come on until after the counter notice had already been issued, or maybe they did come on like as the counter notice was being issued, anything past that counter notice stage, meaning filing this lawsuit in order to claim damages, would not necessarily constitute the attorney's fees that are referenced in 512F. And that's significant because this case has been going on now for almost 2.5 years. The original video was uploaded back in 2007, so you're probably talking about both sides incurring hundreds of thousands of dollars of litigation expenses. And so now the judge has essentially foreclosed that particular type of damages in the form of attorney's fees from this particular case. But again, I think as we've already said, this isn't a decision on the merits of the suit. It's more about what is inclusive in this term damages within Section 512F. And we have not seen a lot of this litigation to date, if any. I mean, I can't really recall too many cases that a person actually filed under 512F seeking damages for a wrongful takedown.
I can think of one case, which was, I think, the Online Policy Group v. Diebold, but that settled before the judge reached the question of damages.
Right, and the judge in this case actually does say that as far as he can tell, this is a question of first impression. That just means that no court has addressed it previously.
And another interesting point is that this ruling doesn't mean that you can't get attorney's fees in a case like this. All that it really means is that there's a separate section in the Copyright Act under Section 505, and that just has a little bit different of a standard than 512F has. So, and I believe under that, it just basically affords the court the discretion to recover full damages for either party in one of these cases, but it doesn't require a judge to allow a party to require or a party to be able to get damages under such a suit.
So, could either of you provide a quick sketch of the standard for damages that the judge laid down, apart from the exclusion of attorney's fees? Is it just any damages apart from that?
It can be any damages. I mean, it was left very broad to mean, I think, both economic damages and damages of other kinds, and that could include just damages in the fact that the video had been taken down for several days. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's limited to just the actual damages that might have been incurred. And that was one of the biggest arguments that UMG set forth. And they were saying that, well, there weren't really any damages here because, how did we actually harm the plaintiff in this case? We issued the DMCA takedown and a counter notice was filed and then the video was put back up. But aside from the inconvenience of having the video down for a couple of days, there wasn't anything else besides that. So what's going to have to happen here, I believe, is that the plaintiff is going to need to show that there was some form of damages that occurred in that time period, and whether you call that frustration or whether they're you can point to it to be some sort of economic damage. I believe the video was uploaded, as the plaintiff said, for the sake of her, you know, showing other family members, her, you know, the her child that was dancing along to the Prince song, and, oh, look at this, look how cute it is, kind of thing. So it will probably be a difficult argument to actually articulate very specific damages that have been incurred, but they might, the EFF and the plaintiff still might be able to do that. Another interesting part of this, though, is that under 512F, she's still going to have to demonstrate that the UMG, the copyright owners, acted with some sort of subjective bad faith when they issued this DMCA takedown. And this is a really interesting question because, as we know, fair use, which is the defense to copyright infringement, is a determined on a case-by-case basis, and so it's usually left up to the discretion of a judge, and it's always kind of difficult. I mean, there are some clear-cut cases, but certainly it can be difficult in some circumstances when you determine whether something qualifies as fair use or not. And sometimes, you know, it's easier if you're some sort of an expert, or if you're an attorney that has a lot of experience in copyright law, it might be easier to identify circumstances in which a video that's uploaded to YouTube might be a pretty clear demonstration of fair use. But and I think that this case probably actually sides more along the lines of, this was definitely more along the lines of a fair use case, because it was 29 seconds of a video. The song that's playing in the background, the Prince song, is very, very, it's like poor quality, because it sounds like it's playing on either a speaker system or a radio or something in the background. So it's not like this was a file that was attached to the video where you can clearly hear that it's Prince's music. Even I couldn't really determine exactly what was playing in the background when I watched this video online. But, and it, again, like we said, 29 seconds, so if you look back to the fair use factors, this probably did not have a strong impact on any of the potential market for the copyright holders, and it was a very small amount of the song that they had sampled, and it was mostly about showing the baby dancing around. This wasn't, you know, meant to serve any commercial purposes or anything along those lines. So the plaintiff is still going to have to demonstrate this bad faith, the subjective bad faith actions by the copyright owners, but you know, we'll have to see where it goes, and again, she'll still have to articulate the damages as well.
Yeah, one interesting thing is that the judge and both parties seem to concede that the costs of filing the counter notice would be covered. So, you know, what small consolation that is, and an opinion that's kind of a mixed bag. You know, the cost of getting your, you know, hiring an attorney if you need to hire an attorney to do it, but to file that counter notice, that should be covered if the suit is successful.
Right, right. And any of the other damages, such as the attorney's fees, would most likely fall outside of that that little calculation right there. And these are very, you know, a counter notice is actually a pretty simple notice. You can find examples of them online. And they really just consist of a few short paragraphs or maybe even sentences, which basically state that you are aware that the video exists there and you believe that it is, you have a good faith belief that it is not an infringing video. And at that point, you're also taking on all of the liability from the online service provider like YouTube.
One thing I'm not 100% sure of is, in this opinion, the judge says that fair use isn't an affirmative defense, that if you're making fair use of something, that use is, you know, non-infringing. It's not that it's infringing, but the infringement is excused. It's that it's a fair use is a non, if you're making fair use of something, you are not infringing whatever that underlying work is. Now, is that the case in all circuits, or is that just a Ninth Circuit thing?
Great question, and I don't have a straight answer to that. I mean, this is like one of those topics that's just been debated over time and somewhat tortured, and because traditionally the way that people have viewed fair use is that it's a defense to infringement. It's not an affirmative right to use some sort of work. But clearly in this case, with the language that you're referencing, Ben, it seems that the judge is taking the opinion that, well, a fair use is not an infringement at all, so it seems to confer some sort of affirmative right. That it might be more limited than we're worrying about here. It might just be for the purposes of a counter notice or a use of a video in these circumstances that it will qualify as a fair use and just a non-infringing use. But in the broader scheme of what happens in the other circuits, I'd have to go back and do the research. I'm not really sure if that's something that's accepted in all of the circuits. And again, we're talking about the Ninth Circuit or the Ninth Circus, depending on how you look at it. So it wouldn't be totally strange if we found out that this is something that is particular to the Ninth Circuit.
Right, because if I recall, fair use isn't one of the enumerated reasons why you can give a counter notice, but the work being non-infringing is. So if you look at it one way, you know, if it makes fair use of it, it's not infringing, then that's a proper reason to file a counter notice. But if you look at the other way, where it's infringing, but fair use is a defense to infringement, in that case, fair use wouldn't be a valid reason to send a counter notice.
All right. Anything else on this story?
I'm all set. David?
Nope.
Let's move on to our next story, which is the Federal Trade Commission's guidelines on employer liability for employee online statements. First, let's take a step back and ask, these are guidelines issued by the FTC. Do they have legal force?
No, they do not. They're not considered to have the force of law themselves, but they're meant to sort of be, guidelines, exactly as you said. They're sort of meant to explain the FTC's thinking in a particular area about how they might approach certain enforcement actions, but just because they've set forth these guidelines doesn't mean that they have to follow them exactly by the words. They don't have the same force of law that other sections of the code or any of the regulations might have.
All right, well, let's talk about what these guidelines say. They cover employer liability for employees' online product endorsements. Specifically, employers could be held liable for statements their employees make on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, MySpace, any blogs they might have, even if the employer doesn't know that the employee makes those statements, and even if the employee doesn't disclose their affiliation with the employer. The commission actually gives an example of, quote, an online message board designated for discussions of new music download technology is frequented by MP3 player enthusiasts. They exchange information about new products, utilities, and the functionality of numerous playback devices. Unbeknownst to the message board community, an employee of a leading playback device manufacturer has been posting messages on the discussion board promoting the manufacturer's product. Knowledge of this poster's employment likely would affect the weight or credibility of her endorsement. Therefore, the poster should clearly and conspicuously disclose a relationship to the manufacturer to members and readers of the message board. In other words, you can't stealth endorse your product by pretending to be a happy consumer when you're actually a paid employee.
That strikes me as fair.
It does, and one of the more interesting things about this post, which was actually on a law firm's website as sort of like this helpful little guide to these new FTC regulations, and by the way, we covered this on a podcast several months ago when these guidelines first came out. The interesting thing about this post, though, was the little spin that they put on it, and they were reading the guidelines to say that if you have a rogue employee, who even if you have some sort of internal policy in place which governs how employees are supposed to communicate with, say, customers or clients or potential customers over social media, even if you have one of those in place and you have a rogue employee who goes out on his own and starts going off and endorsing things, but he's not actually disclosing the relationship between himself and his employer, then you could have a situation where the employer might still be found liable for his activity online. And that's a bit concerning, and the ultimate conclusion of this post was that you need to have very strong policies in place internally when you're a company that, you know, sells products or sells anything which might be marketed online through social media. And it does kind of strike me as fair, but it leaves this gap open that you could have someone going off on his own, completely breaking the rules. And although you might have internal mechanisms to sanction him, you know, through the company, maybe he could be fired, maybe he could get some sort of reprimand or write-up, the company still might be liable in the end if his endorsements cause some sort of consumer product injury or, you know, cause some other type of harm to a person who follows his posts online and where there's no disclosure of that relationship.
The commission did actually note that if there was a rogue employee, they would unlikely take action against the company.
It is sort of difficult to imagine a scenario where the FTC would somehow find out about, I mean, there would have to be a product and some sort of legal harm that occurs from the endorsements for, I suppose, the FTC to really get interested. But we're talking about individuals acting in their individual capacity, or, you know, individual capacity slash, you know, on behalf of the company trying to drive their products or whatever. It's just a little bit difficult to imagine a scenario where that would really play out and you would have the FTC step in and be like, okay, we're going to go after this one guy who was on that one message board, you know, endorsing those MP3 products. I don't know that that's all that likely to happen, but the guidelines at least sort of suggest that it's possible that it can happen. And so because of that, I think it's important for companies to sort of be on the lookout for different other, or actually for ways to control their employees through legal mechanisms, or to make sure that their employees are well informed that these guidelines do in fact exist.
Yeah, I'd like to mention that for the, you know, less controversial part of this, where if an employee on, you know, the company's blog makes a representation about a feature that the device has, that the company would be bound to that, that's nothing new. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you see every day in typical contract law. If you were to go into, you know, some sort of chain electronics store and the employee there made a false representation about, you know, the capabilities of a certain television, you know, you'd be able to sue the company even if the company didn't explicitly authorize the employee to make that statement. You know, as a customer, you had a reasonable belief that the employee would be, you know, allowed to make those representations, and a reasonable belief that it was true. And if you relied on that statement, then, you know, you've got a claim. So that part of it I don't think is very controversial, even if it does happen online. I think the part that more people were latching on to were, as Dave was saying, you know, the fact that even if the employee does this stealthily without the company's knowledge, and I think more importantly, the, you know, the flip side of this that we're not covering so much today, which was the celebrity endorsement. You know, if the, you know, you're paying somebody who has a blog to review this, or if you're giving them a free copy and they make representations of it, that those may be imparted back to you. Those were the more controversial parts of this.
Right, this was definitely meant to target the sort of the third-party review sites, and I think I suspect that this actually occurs more frequently than most people might think. We all know, if you have ever heard, like, trying to search around and find information on an electronic product, for instance, that you were interested in purchasing, if you go to Google and start trying to Google it, you're going to find all these kind of shady review sites, which sort of seem to review it a little bit, but you know, you kind of wonder if there's some sort of financial relationship, or is this just a bit of, you know, is this some sort of marketing that they're just trying to get across through a third party in order to market their product to consumers? And, you know, these are like guerrilla marketing tactics, really. And the other concerning thing is having employees or paying employees to go on to forums, you know, bulletin boards on the internet and make posts which at least appear to be posts by regular people, when in fact that there are people who are being paid by the company to go ahead and try to endorse the products more stealthily by, you know, just saying, oh, this is a great product, I use it all the time, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Here's a hypo for you, though. Suppose we've got an employee of a company, and he has a personal blog, doesn't want it associated with his corporate identity, which is not uncommon, and he comments about a competitor's product from the experience that he has as a consumer of that product, without intentionally implying that it's bad because it's made by a competitor. He's trying to be a neutral observer as best as he can. Nonetheless, he doesn't disclose his affiliation with his employer. Suppose the FTC finds out about this. Let's say this employee knows about the policy, but thought that it didn't apply to him in this case. What happens?
I think under the guise of these new guidelines, the FTC can still step in and initiate an enforcement action against the company in those circumstances because there was no disclosure made. But again, it's a little bit vague because we're talking about guidelines. We don't actually know what the FTC will do in those circumstances. But certainly, I think that there's plenty of authority based on the FTC rules themselves and regulations within the code that would allow the FTC to step in and do that. And additionally, the person who goes out doing that might find himself subject to other types of civil lawsuits between himself and his employer after doing that, especially if there are policies in place at the company.
Here's a neat question. I don't know if we really have time to speculate on it that much, but in the example Dominic gave, I think there's a decent argument that the type of speech that the employee engaged in was non-commercial speech, and as such is virtually immune from regulation by the U.S. government. So, you know, if this is a guy doing this on his own blog, you know, for his own and his readers' edification, I think there's a decent, it may not be a winning argument, but there's a decent argument that it shouldn't, that the FTC shouldn't be able to punish his company for that.
That's a good point, actually, and they do define within these guidelines what an endorsement is, if we're talking about endorsements here by some sort of company representative, and that's any advertising message that consumers are likely to believe represents the opinions or experiences of a party other than the one sponsoring the advertiser. So it would actually probably come down to how the language was actually phrased in the post and how people were likely to perceive that language. So if it was truly neutral, I mean, it could also be the case that that type of speech is outside of the boundaries of what the FTC is looking to enforce here.
Makes sense.
Another corollary to all of this is that something that companies might also be concerned about are like state attorney general offices coming after them or class action lawsuits based off of these guidelines. So even though the FTC doesn't decide to go after somebody or that rogue employee who decides to post endorsements or product testimonials online, they might find themselves still subject to civil lawsuits by the Attorney General's office within a particular state or some sort of mass class action lawsuit from consumers themselves if they find out about it.
Anything else on this story?
Again, all set. David?
Nope.
Let's move on to our third and final story for this week. Facebook has patented the idea of an implicit newsfeed about activities that a user takes on a social network. Notably, this is about implicit activities, so explicit status updates like I am now showering, I am now out of the shower, I am brushing my teeth, stuff like that, that's not the subject of this patent because those are things that the user affirmatively types in and into the social network. So basically, Twitter is not in the purview of this patent. What this patent does cover, though, is implicit activities, like, say, you log on Facebook, you were hiking in the mountains, you upload your photos, and you don't do anything else. Facebook notices that you upload the photos and tells to your closest friends, Dominic has uploaded 14 pictures of his hiking trip in the mountains. This is the sort of implicit event that this patent covers. And specifically, this patent covers the process of generating these news items, then attaching informational links to them, and then attaching active links to them, limiting the number of viewers because of privacy constraints, ordering these events, and then displaying the news items. This is one of those broad software patents that make anti-software people grit their teeth and cry for the abolition of all software patents. It's very, very obvious, they say, and they probably are right. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if this patent did get overturned for obviousness, invalidated for obviousness. But nonetheless, it got issued.
Right. So I think the big story here was that a lot of the news media, including CNN, was reporting that, well, once Facebook had actually been issued this patent, they were concerned that all these lawsuits might be filed against a lot of the competitors in the social media atmosphere. But you sort of killed it right away, and you explained exactly what this patent was about, which I think a lot of the media missed, and that's that it doesn't actually concern those status updates that are issued by the user themselves. It has to do a lot with how other users are viewing and interacting, not just in the interface, but how the, not necessarily the code, but what the functionality is like in the background, when they're viewing other users' status updates and how they're able to manipulate them and sort of click through them and what the drop-down menus might look like and stuff. So I think we've already established here that there's not going to be as many lawsuits based off of this as a lot of the media thought, but it's interesting because Twitter's whole platform is based on like having an open API where third-party programmers can come in and develop applications to interact with the with Twitter, and I could foresee at least a number of scenarios where Facebook might be interested in going after some of those third-party developers, or at least they could, perhaps, depending on how they have developed their applications and how they're interacting with Twitter and how the users through those third-party applications are then able to view the status updates which are issued by Twitter.
For example, a Twitter aggregator service that keeps track of how many updates you make per day and then presents that in some sort of format that's visible to your friends, or tracks a group of people and says this group of people post more on Saturdays than Sundays, or has some sort of news feed-like thing. Interestingly, this application dates back to December 2005 from a provisional application that Facebook filed before they launched the much-hated newsfeed service. And when they did launch it, it created an outcry on Facebook, and people were like, bring back the Facebook, old Facebook, which they still do today with every new update. But the newsfeed was particularly seen as invasive of privacy because it tracked everything someone did on Facebook and presented in an easy-to-follow format. Interestingly, it didn't present anything more than what was available. It just made it that much easier to see what people were doing. You didn't have to track, you didn't have to stalk each profile individually. Facebook did that for you in letting you know that Dominic posted 14 hiking pictures. You didn't have to keep constantly checking his profile to see if there was anything new. You had this nice, convenient list in front of you. I find it more than a touch ironic that this hated feature is now granted a patent.
Yeah, it's a fair point, Dominic. I want to go back, though, to something you said earlier about how, you know, this is a software patent, and you think that this falls into the area of terrible, terrible software patents. I get the software patent argument for a lot of other software, but this one doesn't strike me as terrible, that it is as terrible as other software patents. You know, a lot of the terrible software patents we see are basically mathematical transformations that happen through software. But this really isn't that. There's at least some amount of innovation that went on here. This was, you know, there's a process that goes on, and it doesn't strike me as fundamental as a lot of the software patents we see.
It's easy to fall into the problem of hindsight analysis, where it might seem like something is really obvious today, whereas back in 2006 when this patent was filed, and when they were developing the whole newsfeed portion of Facebook, it might not have been so obvious then to all the other social media websites. And obviously this patent had to be reviewed by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and as much as we might question their activities and what goes on exactly when they decide if something is eligible for a patent, they did grant one in this case. And it's, of course, possible that we might see this particular patent be invalidated at some point in the future for an issue like non-obviousness, but I guess at present we'll have to take it at its face value and sort of defer ourselves a little bit to the USPTO and say, well, if they thought it was not obvious, then there might be some merit to that argument.
I return your comment with a question. What is the inventive step of this Facebook patent, then?
It's not aggregating. It's the fact that it aggregates something that happened on the service as opposed to something that people... I'm just trying to figure out a way to word this so that it sounds like there... so that it sounds better. It's...
the implicit updates.
It's targeting implicit updates and not the explicit updates. I mean, on the flip side, you could say that this is no different from the computer logging in, making a record of when people log into, when users log in, or it's no different from like an HT, an Apache log of, what IP addresses access things. Yeah, in that way, I think you've got a decent point. But, on the flip side,
I sort of see this as basically a prettied up Apache log with some selective privacy controls. Notably, those privacy controls were not in the first iteration that was launched, and the provisional application was later, they later filed the actual application within a year. from the provisional, which lets them go back to that original priority date. But effectively, I see this as a prettified Apache log that tells you, I mean, it's basic. You could generate this from Facebook's Apache logs with a little bit of database interaction and a lot of scripting, which is probably how they do it. Well, probably not from the logs themselves, but from tracking people as they go along.
Right.
And what were you going to say? Sorry.
No, I was trying to go back and make an argument that, you know, maybe it's the privacy controls, but there are privacy controls other places, and I don't think by combining
right.
privacy controls with Apache logs you get something that's, you know, particularly original or that goes beyond the mere combination of the two things, you know. You don't get a patent on a combine by combining whatever the two things that go into a combine are. There has to be something in addition to, you know, the individual parts to get a patent on the combination of those two parts.
I think this is just what has sort of been the problem with software patents. We'd see something like, for example, the Priceline Dutch auction patent. We have something very old, the concept of a Dutch auction, combined with something very new, an internet website. And to a patent examiner who may not be familiar with the cutting edge of technology, this seems like something innovative because you can dress it up so it doesn't look like it's just a combination, but so it looks like it's a little more than that. But upon closer analysis, you realize that it's just the two dovetailed things. And most people don't think that just combining those two things should be patent protection, and the courts would agree when they see them as a mere combination.
Yeah, I want to say, David O'Brien, you are much better playing devil's advocate than I am, because at some point I just break down and give in to the fact that, you know, my original thought was correct, and that me playing devil's advocate is a pointless endeavor.
I'm a little remiss to do it in this circumstance, because Dominic being the patent heavyweight out of the three of us, you know, I'm more interested in what he has to say and why he thinks that something might not qualify for either novelty or non-obvious. And he's made some really strong arguments here. And I might just go back to what I said before, in that you have certain duties when you're prosecuting a patent, that is, you know, filing a patent and trying to get patent protection, and you have to disclose certain types of prior art. And among that, I would think that something as obvious as Apache logs would have had to have been disclosed during the filing process, and that the examiner had to at least have been aware of it, and any of the other surrounding patents that might have had to deal with, you know, any of that underlying functionality or the technology that might be involved in making a method or a process like this. That said, though, you know, the patent was issued, and so apparently they didn't find anything wrong. But we see patents get invalidated all the time, so it's entirely possible that still might happen. And it must have been more than just the combination of those things. That unfortunately, as patents go, this one is pretty broadly written in terms of how it functions, and so it doesn't get terribly specific when it comes down to the technical aspects of how they're actually doing this. So who knows exactly what crossed the patent examiner's desk while he was going over this patent, but I don't know, we'll have to see. And Dominic's arguments, again, I think they sound pretty strong to me.
Yeah, just to touch on ways in which this may get invalidated, very briefly, we can go into this later at some point. I'm sure it'll come up again. You know, there are all sorts of things that can be invalidated through a patent lawsuit. There are things called ex parte and inter parte reexaminations, where you petition the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to take another look at the patent. And, you know, alternatively, this may never really, you know, become a problem. This could be the kind of thing where it's just a defensive patent, where Facebook has just gotten this patent to prevent somebody else from patenting it and suing Facebook.
And also, someone could file a lawsuit for a declaratory judgment, seeking that they are not infringing on a particular patent if they think that whatever they've developed is really close to what the patent says, but they want to clarify that they are not, in fact, infringing on that patent. And throughout the course of those proceedings, you can then also invalidate a patent.
If you haven't looked too much at patents, it's definitely worth looking up this patent. It's not on Google Patents yet, but it should be soon. And if you just Google for the number online, you'll come across people posting PDFs of it, 7669123, 7669123, and just look through the figures. It's really interesting to see how they do it. Usually the first figure will sort of give a broad overview of the invention. So you have, in the figure one, they've got a little cloud, which they call the network, user devices with users attached to them. And then they call themselves the social network provider and a mini feed engine. And then the next figure tells you what's inside this social network provider. Among them, there's a monitoring module, a relationship database, a profile database. And then the next figure talks about what's inside the mini feed engine. There's an activity analyzer, a dynamic list component, an informational link component. These are all very generalized names because they want to make the patent apply as broadly as possible. Part of the art of patent drafting is to claim as much space as possible without going into prior art or getting invalidated for obviousness. You want to carve out as much space for your invention as you can, but not too much. You just have to be just right. It's sort of the Goldilocks problem. Because if you take too little, then a competitor could see that, they only claimed half the space, so we can innovate in the other half and then patent that.
Yeah, I want to say, so the link will be in our show notes, so if you're listening to the podcast, you can just go to our website and there's a link to the patent right there. But also, this is one of the easiest patents to read that I've seen in a while. It did not take a lot of me sitting down and parsing to figure out, you know, what they were claiming and what the bounds of it were. You know, within sitting down to read it, it was maybe 3 or 4 minutes before I realized that it did not, in fact, cover Twitter, which... It's rare for a patent to be that easy to read, in my experience at least.
All right. Anything else on this story, or any of the stories that we've covered?
I'm all set. David?
No, we'll have to see what Facebook does with this, though, in terms of any potential lawsuits out there, and maybe if there's anything that Twitter or Google Buzz have to worry about, since they seem to have at least somewhat similar functionality to some extent in terms of what this patent claims. But... like we mentioned in the beginning, we certainly don't see this as the harbinger of death that all the news media seem to think that it was.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in and say Google Buzz does definitely will post something like if you use Google Reader and you share something on Google Reader, it'll show up in Google Buzz, which would count as an implicit thing as opposed to an explicit status update, which most of the rest of Google Buzz is. So Google Buzz may fall into this. I'd have to double-check and reread the patent to see if it does, but it's definitely a closer fit than Twitter.
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of borderline case. Google chat statuses would be another thing, because you'd put the chat status into your Google Talk client, not into Google Buzz, but it's still explicit content. But then you could argue, well, isn't uploading a photo to an album also explicit content? So, I mean... it'll be interesting to see how broadly they enforce the patent, and that's going to come down to the nitty-gritty of interpreting the claims in light of the specifications of the patent, and that's what patent attorneys and patent litigators are for. So we'll keep you updated on the story. Thanks for listening this week. If you have any comments, questions, insights, or suggestions, please email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Please visit our website at technicallylegal.org and subscribe to our podcast and RSS feed. Thank you for listening. I'm Dominic Rabi.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Have a great week.